Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you aboard. It is the 2nd of October, a Wednesday, and we are thrilled to have you all here. We got a great group. Let's get to it. Introduce everybody all proper-like. Dean of College of Emergency of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Good morning, Joey. I'm looking forward to a perfect roundtable today.
It's going to be perfect. Absolutely perfect.
They're all perfect.
Yes. SUNY New Paltz Communications Professor, former New York State Senator Terry Gibson. Good morning, sir.
That was perfect. Thank you.
You're welcome. Times Union columnist Chris Churchill. Hello, Chris. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for asking. I appreciate it. Investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo. Hi, Rosemary.
Hi. I'm sober today.
Boo.
Going to be a dull show, people.
As opposed to most days?
Okay. No, just most Wednesdays.
Oh, all right.
I visit my neighbor.
That's right. Yeah. The neighbor. Well.
99-year-old.
Equally sober, I believe. WAMC's Alan Chartok. Good morning, sir.
You betcha.
All right. We have a lot to talk about, but let's talk about the lockbox first. Alan, go to it.
Well, we're doing okay. We're a little bit ahead of where we were the last year at this time. Nevertheless, in the end, it's never any good unless we get it. And the question always is, what is the passion? What is the level of passion that we all have for this radio station? Is it necessary in our lives? Do we tune into it? Did we make it? Did we put something in the last time that made it go? So that's what it's about, and I know I'm passionate about it, and I hope everybody else is too. Joe, how much is in?
We have right now $180,381 in. So that's $319 to go before the beginning of the fund drive, 2.5 weeks until the fund drive begins on October 21st.
Now, the bad news is that's a lot of money.
Yes.
The good news is we can do it. We've done it before and we can do it.
Now, we also, don't forget, have tickets to the Capitol Steps at the Egg. It's a pair of tickets for $150. And as you mentioned yesterday, Alan, this is an event. This is an annual event that we've had for many, many years now. Every year it sells out. So if you want your tickets, now's the time to do that.
And we're all together and we all get together. It's not only the Capitol Steps, which it is, of course, and they're great, but it's also our time to meet up with each other and say hello, howdy do, and we do that. And that's why I love it, and that's why I always feel bad when somebody calls me at the last minute and says, but they're all gone, and you can find me a ticket. And I always say, no, I told you in the beginning you have to do it now. So I'm asking everybody to do it, A, because it really will help fill the lockbox, but B, because I want to see you there.
It is a pair of tickets to Capitol Steps at the Egg Friday, November 1st at 7:30, and we're doing this during the lockbox time, and we want to make sure that we can fill that lockbox, get it up to 500,000 before we start the drive on the 21st of October. It's $150, pair of tickets, Capitol Steps, November 1st at 7:30, WAMC.org. You can also give us a call, 1-800-323-9262.
I really want to hear from everybody because that's what we are. That's where we live.
All right. We will make it so. All right. Let's start off and talk about what's going on in the news. You know, there's still a lot of news going on.
I think it's only one story.
All right. So, as impeachment fights begin, administration and Congress clash over deposition. This has become very complicated. Of course, we didn't expect it not to be, but the Trump administration clashed on Tuesday with leaders of the House impeachment inquiry over their demands to question State Department officials who might have witnessed President Trump's efforts to pressure Ukraine for political advantage. In the first skirmish in what promises to be an epic impeachment struggle, this from the New York Times, between the executive and legislative branches, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo lashed out at three congressional committees that are seeking to depose diplomats involved in American policy toward Ukraine. Mr. Pompeo called their demands for confidential interviews an act of intimidation. The House postponed the first of the depositions, which had been scheduled for Wednesday with the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, but not before the impeachment inquiry's leaders asserted, rather upbraided, Mr. Pompeo for questioning their work and for asserting that their bid to swiftly schedule depositions did not allow enough time for a proper response. The latest standoff unfolded as lawmakers were unexpectedly put on notice Tuesday afternoon that they could soon be provided with new evidence related to the State Department and Ukraine, a twist that could add crucial information to their investigation and potentially complicate Mr. Trump's efforts to block it. So on the Democratic side, you have a House Speaker and Democrats who have said, we want to do this and we want to do this quickly. And then you have Republicans who are saying, we need more time, we need more time, or we're not going to do this at all. Alan, where are we right now?
Well, we're in a place where I keep thinking, what's Mike Pompeo going to be thinking after Trump is out of there? He had a chance to be a distinguished American, and he blew it. Look, they keep playing on the television and everywhere else his denials that he was on the call, and then he was on the call. You know, it looks like the last thing in the world these guys want to do is to get caught in what is obviously a mess. And I keep wondering. I'd love to hear what Rosemary has to say about this one, but I keep wondering what they are going to be thinking when this is all over.
Go ahead, Rosemary.
Go ahead. Wow. Well,
rest of us will just stay quiet.
Rosemary, what do you have?
Yeah, I really don't want to hear from the rest of you. Yeah. Rosemary, go ahead.
Well, we'll just take our show on the road, man. Go to a coffee shop.
Lindsey Graham has been the most interesting to me because he totally went from talking exactly about what Trump was before the rest of us knew it, and then he became a sycophantic slave. And Pompeo now, I see this and say he's highly ambitious. He went into this thinking he could navigate it, but he had to have known how risky that was this weekend. He was on that call and he was everywhere defending the president, saying, oh no, I haven't even seen the transcript yet. What, how do you think you're going to get away with that? It's hubris written real large in Washington these days. That's all I can think of. It's not very insightful, and I would like to hear from my co-panelist.
Oh,
well, if I'm going to be allowed to give an opinion, I'll just say that, you know, I think what kind of
Gladys Knight lets the pip say.
Peep, peep. You know, I think at the heart of that story is you have two different motives. You have the Trump administration, which would really love to slow this thing down as much as possible.
Right.
Stretch it into the next election cycle. Because, you know, the closer we get to an election, the less legitimate this is going to seem. And Democrats in the House obviously want this to go as quickly as possible, and they may be being a little bit unrealistic, you know, with how quickly they're pushing it. If you look at how long Watergate took to play out, or most other scandals take to play out, you know, to think that you're going to just be able to do this in a matter of months,
turn it on a dime.
Yeah, it may just not be. I mean, this is complicated stuff, you know.
Yeah, well, but if I could just jump on that thought, though, there's a couple of other elements that I'd like to toss on the table. One, this has huge ramifications for the Senate race in Kansas as well. Don't lose sight of that. That Pompeo was considered to be a leading potential
Correct.
Candidate out there.
Correct.
So this kind of throws that up in the air. The other element of interest to me is the State Department IG coming today to meet with both Senate and House committees on in a very unusual move. And I don't know what is going to be discussed, but my sense is that we're sort of starting to avalanche down a hill here. And I think I think the denials from Pompeo last week are going to get lost in a much bigger storm of information coming out of the State Department.
So what do you think the IG's got in his quiver there? I mean, that it's either that he sent himself or that they sent him. I think that's what we're all thinking.
Yeah, I think it's important enough where the IG was seeking congressional consultation during a period when Congress is actually out of session. So it goes to show you how important I think the IG feels that this information is. I don't know exactly what's in there. I am really waiting with a little bit of bated breath. And again, I don't know if it's going to be that one single smoking gun. But when you start to think about all of these elements now, from the Mueller report to, you know, the intelligence community
IG report to something else coming out of State Department, this potentially could be linking a lot of dots.
Well, we know the IG wants to talk about the topic of Ukraine. We know it's in that category. So it potentially information that expands on this call that we keep focusing on. So there, we may find out that there is so much more than just this one call that was going on with this Ukraine arrangement. You know, I just think Republicans learned back during their refusal to put Merrick Garland up for a hearing for the Supreme Court. They learned that the delay tactic, the resist tactic, the slowdown tactic, just the flat-out ignoring the Constitution, worked pretty well for them. And I think they're trying it again, except this time there is so much information seeping in from all different directions that it just may not work this time.
You know, we got all revved up when the Mueller report was about to come out and then when Mueller spoke, and that was all a dud. And I fear that we could be headed that way again. But with the Inspector General coming and also the former Ukrainian ambassador, the woman who was ousted by Giuliani and the shadow government, she's speaking early next week also to Congress. The one other thing is that the Democrats learned from Garland, too, which is, yeah, they're going to keep delaying and we're going to push in. They're acting much more aggressive now than you saw them during Merrick Garland or at any other time, which is Pompeo, shut up or you're going to be charged with obstruction.
Absolutely.
You never heard that before.
Absolutely. It's vital that the Democrats keep pushing. Even if they're being slightly unrealistic, they have to keep pushing because there is no opening. They've got to stay in control of the message.
Bob used the term avalanche too, but I think that's an apt term because not only are we moving this quickly, and Chris, you mentioned that it may not be realistic, but the other side of this too is that unlike the news is happening so fast, the breaking stories, the people who are leaking, the people who are saying, oh, he was on this phone call, he wasn't, and finally he admitted this morning he was on the phone call. So this is we're seeing these stories just break loose that it's almost hard to keep up even for members on the House.
Yeah. So Joe, you get Volcker, obviously,
right,
who is thinking his own position in all of this. You get the potential for the IG saying, hey, I don't want to carry these guys water for this. And once that breaks loose, there could be all hell to pay.
You also have to keep in mind that oftentimes, by the time we hear this breaking news, there are many people in government, possibly Nancy Pelosi and people like that have already heard it. Yeah. Maybe hours before, maybe minutes before, maybe days before. So they may very well and could very well and often are two steps ahead of the public.
Well, we thought that last week, right?
The
transcript.
What does that mean?
Well, it just means that there are always things going on that we are, as the public, are not aware of. And there are things in motion that we can't possibly be aware of.
I was going to say Congress leaks very fast, that especially something like this. The other interesting thing that came out this week is that someone read the notes, the whatever we're calling them, the non-transcript, and they come up to 12 minutes of conversation at normal tone of voice. That was a 30-minute conversation.
But I thought that was translation. My understanding was that it was what was it? It was translation.
Yeah. As I understood it, there's still 12 minutes missing.
Oh God, not 12 minutes of tape.
I know.
Missing.
Does that sound like? Yeah.
No, I had the original my original because this came up right after the
you may be right, Joe.
And I was told, I wasn't told. Nobody told me anything. But it was I heard or read that it was made up for the translation from Trump to the president of Ukraine, from the president of Ukraine to Trump.
That would make sense, actually. Double the time.
Yes.
And you know,
okay,
Joe,
never mind.
You know, talking about the speed.
Here to help.
We actually are working now at the speed of a reality TV show rather than government.
Yeah.
And I think that's a major difference. And I think the point that Terry raised is really interesting, that this is a very different level of aggression and movement because.
So we have to get this in before fall sweeps.
Yeah. Well, you know, you say that, but there is a patent to this. Also, don't sleep on Grassley's comments. That was the one that really put my antenna up.
Yeah.
Grassley has been, for all of his faults, a huge supporter and proponent of a whistleblower protection act, and the idea that we have to make it fair for people to come forward in a way that shows waste, fraud, and corruption. And he came out strongly against the administration on this whole whistleblower piece, and that's sort of one of those cracks that I look at as an important bellwether of sort of changing philosophy.
I just want to say one thing here, and that's a great point, because we have a president of the United States who's saying, in contradistinction to what Grassley is saying, I want to talk to this guy. And that's after he's already dragged him through the mud and said he must be a bad guy, basically. And, we have a president who is saying, and I think there's dark music playing in the background, I want to know who he is, and we have to and we all know that this guy deserves protection.
I almost feel like many of the things Trump has said since the inquiry got started are more impeachable than the actual phone call. I mean they're more disturbing than the actual phone call in many respects. I mean, he's clearly not responding well to this. I mean, I guess no president is going to respond well to being, you know, the threat of impeachment. But even so, I mean, some of the stuff he's saying is just obviously beyond the pale.
I just wanted to go back to Grassley's comments before.
Go ahead.
Just a reminder that Grassley also, while supporting the whistleblower, he was very resistant to letting people testify during the Supreme Court hearings. If you remember that with Kavanaugh, he was really not supporting those testimonies.
I'm going to hold you there. We'll be back right after this.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Terry Gibson, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo make up the panel. We welcome your thoughts. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So we know that Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff were expected to have a press conference this morning at 10:45. We also know that the president is expected to make comments to the press at 2 o'clock this afternoon. And, of course, as you mentioned, the State Department IG will be going to Capitol Hill. So it should be a busy day of things going on. Let's go to some letters. We'll start there and then continue the conversation. Mike writes, I was reading Section 3, Clause 6 of the U.S. Constitution. You know, like you do.
Just happened to be reading it.
Yeah, just it was in between whites.
I didn't bring my Constitution today.
It says when the U.S. Senate tries a president for impeachment, as Mitch McConnell has implied would happen, the Chief Justice presides. What would John Roberts' role be? And do you think it is a good thing John Roberts would be involved?
Yes.
Yes.
I do.
I don't think it's a choice whether it's a good thing or not. I think it's I think it's required by the Constitution.
The way it is.
But a good thing. He cares about institutions. He cares about the Constitution.
He cares about fairness. And I think he would lend a certain credibility to the whole thing, especially for people on the right.
There was an interesting article a couple of weeks ago about Rehnquist and how he handled the impeachment that I don't remember where I read it, but it was really excellent about sort of laying out the role of the Chief Justice and the thinking of the court as far as its role.
Mm-hmm. We got this letter from Jay, who says, the real bottom line, when push comes to shove, the real power in America is not the local sheriff or state police. It's with the military. With that in mind, I would like to know what the military would do if Trump decides he isn't going after he's been told to go.
They wouldn't do anything. There was an article or a column in the New York Times this morning speculating on what, you know, Trump refusing to go. And I just don't buy it all. I don't think the military would take his side. I don't think people who work at the White House would take his side. I think he refused to go. Security would escort him out, just like they would escort anybody else out who's been fired.
I'm more concerned, I think, about the whole issue of posse comitatus and the role of the military in domestic affairs. And I think under this administration and under this particular Department of Defense, they've been much more active than I'm comfortable with in the continental United States. And again, I'm not questioning the loyalty or patriotism of any single person. I do worry about sometimes the organizations. This is also why, even though I love General Mattis, I thought it was a mistake to make him Secretary of Defense. Mm-hmm. I think the idea of a firewall between the uniformed services and civilian control and the constant message of civilian control over the military is absolutely essential. I also worry that, you know, the president does give directions sometimes to violate the law, which really, really scares me.
And apparently people follow that direction, is what we're seeing. And,
like shoot migrants?
Well, I don't know if
or
they've done that yet, but
and
they, they've done some other things.
Yeah.
I'm just concerned that the longer he's there and the more he surrounds himself with people that are unwilling to stand up to him, that his ability to lock the place down and to not leave, I think, becomes something to be worried about.
Yeah, and as we move to the C, D, and E team, because the top people have been run out, I think you're going to see more of that circle of the wagon and basically the idiocy of the comments that we saw in some of the articles about the flesh-piercing spikes and shooting people in the legs and things that are they're illegal and they're so morally repugnant. They reflect nothing that's good about this country.
I want to talk about that article in some depth in a moment of what we heard from the transcript. Well, not the transcript, but the recreation of the conversation that took place in March over the closing of the border. Let me just go to a couple letters and then we'll get to that because I think it's scary. Ray writes, this is the way I see it. Vladimir Putin is pulling Donald Trump's strings, and a civil war is exactly what makes us weak. Putin can then do the damage he wants to inflict on us. I don't like conspiracy theories, but that performance in Helsinki proves to me that Trump is working for Putin. The so-called patriots on the right supporting Trump don't know they're traitors yet. What will happen when they find out they supported a traitor?
Interesting letter. Mm.
We just go ahead. What was I going to say?
Yeah, I was just going to say I think the big benefit, whether this was actively planned or just dumb luck, is Putin. They remain an incredible threat to our way of life and democracy, and it's something. If you think about not just the United States, you start to think about what's going on with UK and Europe. It's a destabilizing, and we're accelerating the destabilization of
and
the Western
democracies.
And they are winning.
The latest news is that Ukraine's president, the former comedian, is now meeting with Putin to discuss the ending the hostilities, which would clear the way for, okay, I didn't really invade your country and take over half of it, and now I'm getting autonomy in the eastern part, but get rid of those sanctions, which, of course, has been a drumbeat for Trump.
It's really Trump's just ignorance and incompetence that has played right into the hand of Putin. I mean, he's just made it so easy for them.
Yeah, but
Alan thinks it's more sinister.
Yeah,
I do.
It could be.
What if? Let's just do a what if here. What if Putin has had his way? What if, in fact, Trump is the president of the United States because of what Putin did? And therefore Trump has what a movie this is. And therefore, Trump has, and it is very.
Yeah, but what if, Alan? We had a 2-year Mueller investigation that looked into these things, and it came up empty.
No, it didn't.
It came up empty.
It came up without enough to bring it into court.
Well, it said there is no evidence of collusion or conspiracy.
No.
What?
No, it did. No.
That's the Republican talking point you're throwing back at me.
That's Bill Barr's talking point. That's a quote from I'll bring it up.
That's how they were able to take control of the conversation and make the Mueller report go away.
Well, but Mueller was quite forthright in terms of Russian interference in all of this. And all I'm saying is nobody has ever decided whether or not Putin really won the election for Trump. There is a possibility that that happened.
Yeah, and there doesn't even need to be collusion, as far as I'm concerned. We know, I think, pretty factually that Russia was involved in our campaign. It was involved in Brexit. It's been involved in all of the Western democracies' campaigns. This is a pattern of offensive behavior by the Russians. So whether they colluded with them directly or not, they absolutely impacted the election.
The investigation did not find sufficient evidence that the campaign coordinated or conspired with the Russian government.
Sufficient evidence, though. Well, come on, there were tens of contacts, which was documented in the Mueller report, which I'm now reading. And it would not stand up to the beyond a reasonable doubt standard that you have to use in the court.
Well,
of
I'm just
law,
saying if a 2-year investigation with all the resources the Mueller people had isn't going to find anything, maybe people should just accept that there isn't much there.
And maybe Mueller was a big disappointment.
But we do know that Russia is on record for having interfered in our elections,
yes,
one way or the other. We know. I mean, that's an agreed-upon talking point. Sure. Whether there was collusion or not, that, you know, you can argue with that if you want.
Yeah.
We also know the president is on record of saying that doesn't really bother him. The fact that Russia would meddle in our elections just doesn't really bother him. He's on record
saying
that.
Plus, he did it again in Ukraine.
So to go back to it, though, I actually don't think the Mueller report was a disappointment. I think it is what it is. But, you know, don't forget that, you know, we came out with a number of indictments, and not just members of the campaign, but I think there's approximately 12 Russian generals that were identified,
right,
or officers that were identified by name for their role in influencing the election. So I just didn't want to lose that.
I also think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that it shouldn't be disappointing to people that there wasn't collusion or that they weren't able to find evidence. That should be considered good news.
That is good, right?
And the fact that so many people are disappointed by it, it says something to the American people. It says to people that they're more interested in getting Trump out than they are about, you know, the facts or what's best for the country. It's a good thing that they weren't able to find sufficient evidence of collusion.
But when you look at this call that we
I'm gathering up strength here, Terry. Go.
No, I just want to say, you know, but just to Chris's point,
this
when
what
you look
happens
at this
when you're
call
sober.
That our president had,
yeah, no,
the president,
you're much happier and easier to
go, Terry.
No, I was going to say.
Sorry.
I don't even remember. When you look at the call that the president had with the president of Ukraine, you can see why people want to see the fact that collusion actually happened be proved, because it sure looks like it's happening right in front of us.
Exactly.
Everything Trump does, everything he says, everything we have a record of points to the fact that that sure looks like collusion. How can that not be collusion?
And this is a guy who said he loves the Russians, he loves Putin. You know, come on now. This is on its face not healthy.
As Bob says, there's abundant evidence in the Mueller report and from other investigations done by all of our intelligence agencies that the Russians have been involved in our elections. Nothing has been done about it by this administration going forward, or even by the Obama administration. I fault them. They knew too and did not act until it was after the 2016 presidential elections to take any steps. And Republicans, who used to be the ones who like saw the red scare, the whole Mitt Romney, the Russians are the main threat, boy was he right, they're now saying, oh well, we interfere in elections too, what's the big deal? Come on, it is a big deal. It's the major threat against national security in this country, according to the to McGuire in his hearing the other day.
Nicholas writes, 2 days ago, he mentioned civil war. Yesterday, he called the impeachment inquiry a coup. It sounds like a call to arms and reinforces what Alan has been saying. Hell no, he won't go, even if he's voted out of office next election. It is truly disturbing.
Well, it's not a coup, because if it was a coup, it would feel very different than what he's going through right now. Right now, we're actually trying to go through something that the Constitution says that we're supposed to do, and there's a process to it. It is a slow process. It's a frustrating process, but coups don't happen like that. Coups are very aggressive, and they can happen in a matter of hours.
Nonsense. Coups can happen in a whole range of ways. One of them, and by the way, I never said that. What I am saying is it's a possibility. I think this guy won't want to leave office. I don't think he wants to go to jail. I think he's going to have to go to jail if he's thrown out, and that's the last thing he wants. But coups don't have to be everybody marching in step, or they can be done in a number of different ways.
All right, let's take a break. We will pause. When we come back, we'll continue. We have more letters. We'll talk about other stuff as well. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Bob Griffin is here, Terry Gibson, Rosemary Armeo, Chris Churchill, and Alan Shartok. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We go to Rick's letter, who says, when will the Dems get Trump's New York State tax filings? Finding out more about his financial entanglements with foreign powers is key to understanding his corruption and should be considered during impeachment investigations. From what we're told, it is a part of the impeachment investigations, correct?
Wasn't there just a federal judge ruling on this? That
was California's
yes.
law, though. Yeah. California passed a law that you can't run if you don't turn in your taxes, and judge is holding it up.
We got this from Sharon, who said in an article in the Wall Street Journal last Friday, there were two small paragraphs that mentioned a meeting in the White House between Donald Trump and Wayne LaPierre, the head of the NRA. The specifics of the meeting were private, but the gist was how the NRA could be of support to Trump with the latest allegations and move towards impeachment. I have not heard anything more about this alliance, but it definitely frightens me. Nothing good or peaceful seems to come out of backing a scared and desperate animal into a corner. Anyone else as scared as I am about what Trump and his gun-loving supporters may do?
Yeah, the only thing worse than backing a animal into the corner is giving him a gun. And that's pretty – I mean, I saw the same thing. I think the writer is spot on, is that you're starting to see a – you know, we use the term quid pro quo, but I do think there's quid pro quos about support and putting resources in, take pressure off of you for – the president not supporting gun legislation. It's really clear, and it goes back to the Citizen United case and the fact that we weakened all of the laws that tries to keep this dirty money out of politics.
That's right.
Also, we got this from Lillian, who writes, most would be country over president. That's been our experience with active duty spouses recently retired. Granted, that's the nuclear navy, not infantry army. They may be different. The military as a whole is not a group of automatons ready to fire on their friends and neighbors on the orders of the president.
Yeah, that's good.
It's an excellent point.
Okay, I have to do a tangent here because of all this talk about animals and backed in a corner. Did you see the woman who jumped into the lion's enclosure at the Bronx Zoo?
Yes.
Wow, that took my mind off of Trump for a while.
I didn't see that.
Did you see the video of the airport cart going around in circles? That took my mind off of Trump, too.
No, but I'll look that up now.
Yes, that was Leaping Darwinism.
For those of us who didn't follow the lion story, perhaps you could bring us up.
Yeah, well, there's video on it. You must go. And talking about it doesn't do it justice. A woman inexplicably went into the lion's enclosure and began, you know, teasing the lion. And she's just lucky to be alive.
She's lucky that lions don't dance. She was trying to dance with the lion.
Yeah.
That's odd. Okay.
Okay, sorry.
Oh, so this is just from like a day ago. She taunted a lion after climbing over the safety barrier at the New York Zoo. Huh. All right. Well, we'll look that up. That'll be our homework.
Thanks, Rosemary.
Thank you.
That
sorry.
Was a great addition.
Sorry.
Wow.
And as long as we're catching up, perhaps you could, Bob, I guess it was Bob who talked about something comitatus. You could translate that for us.
Oh, posse comitatus is,
yeah.
Thank you, Alan. The legal constraint of the military from operating within the continental United States. So after the Civil War, it's a constraint that's put on the military as a way of in part avoiding the whole issue of a coup, but also because of the effects of the Civil War and the sense of armed soldiers acting in police power. So basically what happens is the military cannot operate like a law enforcement agency. Which is why when everybody says during a disaster, we should be sending the military in, they could police, they really can't. They don't have the legal authority to do that.
What about going to the border? That's a police action.
National Guard. It's a difference between regular military versus the National Guard. Remember, the National Guard is under the governors.
Pardon us, but the National Guard looks an awful lot and smells an awful lot like the military to us. I mean, certainly Dwight Eisenhower understood that.
It was the military, though. Mattis went and comforted them and said, "You're doing a great job, boys."
Yeah, and there, but again, for humanitarian support, you can put military. You cannot put armed military to do law enforcement. And there's also a difference between regular military and Title 10 versus Title 32, which is National Guard.
So, in other words, there's lots of ways around it.
There
and
are,
Trump's finding them. Got
you
it.
Got it.
So, does this play, Bob? Does this play into when the president orders the border guard to shoot migrants in the legs to keep them from crossing? Does that factor in?
Well, no, because the border guard, the border protection, is actually part of DHS. They're actually federal law enforcement. When you start
I'm
to talk,
sure that'll be comforting.
Well, once again, yeah. All of our traditions and norms can be gone around, circumvented easily. It appears,
but someone in that meeting had to tell the president of the United States, "No, sir, that's illegal."
And, you can't shoot them in the leg, and you can't put alligators and snakes in the moat.
Jeez.
And then if you look at the comment of what he did to the DHS secretary,
Kirstjen Nielsen,
you know, the comment about honey, which I can't think of a more patronizing comment to make.
He called her sweetheart
and honey.
You know,
It's not surprising.
She deserved it. She was horrible. She signed up
for
that.
No one deserves
no,
that.
No one deserves that.
Oh, no. Nonsense.
Oh,
nonsense.
Nonsense.
Right. Nonsense.
Okay, this is ganging up on a woman, guys.
But you're ganging up on a woman. I mean, the woman was trying to do her job.
She signed up to work for Trump.
Yeah, but
and she sat there and said, no, that's not a cage. That's a security enclosure. Come on. I have no sympathy for her, honey.
I don't know. Can we assume that if he's speaking to her like that, that is a way that he probably speaks to women in general?
I'm shocked, Joe, to think they're shocked.
I'm just saying.
Yes, I do think you can assume that.
I do think some of the people in the administration do deserve sympathy, though. Some of them have been trying to restrain his worst impulses, and I think that is a patriotic duty that some of them are taking on.
I look at them and I would really like to believe this. You have Omarosa who came out. She didn't restrain anything. She wrote a book.
Omarosa,
you have Mattis who came out and wrote a book that was all about honor and didn't even name Trump. You have Bolton who's saying, oh, yeah, we're doing a bad job in North Korea not naming Trump. Kelly who came out and now he's working for private concerns that are caging children on the border, making money off of it.
You tell him, Rosemary.
They're not honorable people. Sorry, no.
Some of them... It's a complicated thing, but as impeachment plays out, and if this gets further and deeper and goes to the Senate, the one chance that I think this has to succeed is guys like John Bolton and Mattis and Tillerson coming forward and saying, "Listen, this guy has to be removed. We worked there. He's insane," you know. And I think some of them, we didn't have border agents shooting migrants in the legs. And that's because people refused his orders. If you don't have people there who are willing to do that, I think we're really in trouble.
Well, I have to agree with Chris to some degree in that these are the very people that we may very well need to come back and testify and share information with us. And Kirstjen Nielsen may be on that list. She may have very valuable information.
And by the way, she's clearly the source on this story. I mean, if you read that story, don't think that she was interviewed for it.
Yeah, I agree with that.
She's the one who's telling us about all this stuff. The people you named are the major leakers who give us a lot of the information that we have about what's going on behind the walls.
But it did happen in March.
We cannot make the mistake that Adam Schiff made and start accusing everybody of running a mafia operation. We can't do that. Not in public. Because as soon as we start making accusations about these individuals that demean their character, we lose the opportunity to control the message and get information out of them that we need to actually win this fight.
I'm sorry, we're talking about honorable behavior. Honorable is not getting yourself fired and then slinking off and maybe leaking a story months later. It's standing up and saying, I quit, I'm resigning, and here's why. And then Congress could act immediately on it. I just don't see, I want to see honorable behavior, I do not.
I think we're debating two different things. I'm not debating. I agree with you that it's not honorable behavior.
But these
are very useful people that we need to be sure that we don't just push out to the pasture because we're going to need their help.
Okay. I can agree on that. Still, I'm not sorry she got called honey, which is a horrible insult for a professional woman.
With that, we go to Kevin, who says, Trump's collusion. He colluded in open sight on TV. The end. Dana on collusion. Whoever is speaking now about a lack of evidence of collusion does not either understand the report or has not done a lot of research. There was lots of collusion. Collusion is not illegal. The report focused on a very specific and narrow case, namely criminal conspiracy with the Russian government.
Right.
This is where you say nonsense, Chris. That would have required planned level of coordination. It is clear there was collusion and the campaign welcome to the interference from mutual benefit. We go to a letter from Alan, who says it's not a coup. It doesn't meet the criteria for a coup insofar as the majority of the government would still be in place, and unless also implicated successor Pence will assume the presidency should Trump be removed. We go to David.
Well, I think the only person using the term coup is the president.
President, right? Yes. Yeah, so we're not making that determination.
Is that even right? I mean, if you remove the elected leader, that's a coup.
Well, if you remove it legally, the impeachment process is not a coup.
That's correct. That is correct.
David writes, Trump reportedly believes a completely upside-down conspiracy theory. He refuses to believe that the Russians interfered in our election. Instead, he believes that the DNC framed the Russians. Mm-hmm.
Also on Russia, Pierre says Russia interfered. So what? We interfered in their elections and too many others around the world. You called it, Rosemary. You said it was coming.
I love that explanation.
It has been what we do. Chickens coming home to roost. Let's move on to getting the orange blowhard out, says Pierre. And then Polly says, you probably remember when Trump was a candidate, he made a big prediction that Obama would refuse to leave office if he, Trump, won. This, among so many other statements, tells us exactly what he would do in a similar situation.
Except Obama wasn't facing an orange jumpsuit when he left office.
Yeah, I don't remember him saying that. Do you remember him accusing Obama of...
Mm-hmm.
I don't.
All right. We are going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a lot more to discuss. Alan Chartok, Terry Gibson, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo making up the panel. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Don't forget to help the lockbox. You can also get your Capital Steps tickets, $150 for a pair. The performance is November 1st. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org for the letters, WAMC.org to help the lockbox. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok is here, Terry Gibson, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So we have this letter from Cheryl, who says Rosemary is totally correct. They, Mattis, Bolton, Omarosa, etc., are not honorable people. The thing for this country is for Trump to be removed from office.
Can we can make the point about Bolton and all the other serious. Can we not include Omarosa in that rundown of people?
She had such a high-ranking position. And it was highly visible.
Well, she shouldn't have had it, but
yeah,
she's not a—I mean—
She's not serious, yeah.
She
yeah.
came from a reality TV show.
So did the president.
Yes, I'm aware of that.
I'm just saying, you know, I think—
I'm aware of that.
Maybe the rules have changed.
Yeah.
Erica says, on the Colbert Show last night, Rachel Maddow claimed there is a second whistleblower with evidence of a cover-up in the Trump tax investigation.
This is old. It's she first revealed it out of the Neal Commission that's been looking at his tax returns. And there is a whistleblower who has said the IRS is not handling the audit of the president's returns as they are supposed to, as they are required to. And they went to Congress. But there's no other details. He is trying to do whatever you do to declassify this whistleblowing material so he can speak out. It's not new. It actually predates the whistleblower we're all talking about now.
Drew writes and says, no one ever talks about the fact that senators themselves will also be under oath in an impeachment trial. That's why this is my favorite part of Article 1, Section 3. The Senate shall have the sole power to try all impeachments. When sitting for that purpose, they shall be on oath or affirmation. When the President of the United States is tried, the Chief Justice shall preside. Second favorite part, the party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to law.
So does everybody pretty much agree that a trial is a foregone conclusion at this point, that it's going to happen?
No.
I mean, that seems to be what everybody is assuming.
I do not agree.
No.
I think there are lots of scenarios where it would be in the Republicans' best interest not to have a trial, either because they have decided that this president is going down and they don't want all the awful details to come out in a trial, and they just throw him under the bus and say, we're not doing this.
And they have to figure out what to do for 2020 as well.
Or they just decide to do what they did with the Merrick Garland hearings and just don't do it and see how far they can go with that. I mean, there's different ways to play with this.
Alan?
But it's entirely possible that they are going to do it and that they have to do it and that McConnell knows he's going to do it. And I think his hint was, I don't know how long, he said something like that, it will be. But I think what they do is they do it fast, and they get out of there. That's my bet.
Oof. I think Pelosi has cleverly arranged it so that she can keep evaluating. She's really, it doesn't feel that much different to me than what we had before, a bunch of inquiries. And then she can say, bring it to a vote for impeachment, or just say, no, we're going to go. We're going to keep on investigating. Yeah, I think she's cleverly arranged it.
I don't know. To go back to the avalanche analogy, I mean, I think it's going down the hill now at this point.
This stuff today.
Down the hill is right.
Yeah, this stuff today is interesting.
Down the hill is right. The stock market is down 308 points right now. Something's up, gang.
I don't know how she would hold it back at this point. I mean, the momentum is just, you know, and the thing about an avalanche is you don't know exactly what it might crush,
right.
You know, and it could do as much damage to Democrats as it could to Republicans. But I just don't see how there isn't a trial and how they don't vote for impeachment at this point.
I don't know. I see so many things. I think it's a fluid avalanche that can go off in any direction at any given time, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the lava can flow different ways.
Oh, lava. I was thinking something else when you were saying anything.
Yeah, well, that's a mixed
metaphor. So, I mean, there's a lot of mixed metaphor there.
I'm going to keep an open mind about
what
you
went from cold to hot. I like that.
Yeah.
From avalanche to lava.
Yeah.
So Chris made this point, I believe.
Nonsense this morning.
That's you were the only one that actually committed that you were sober.
<That's>
the
true.
Rest of us, it's open for interpretation.
Let's talk more about the lions.
That's a heck of a story.
How about how about the alligators and the snakes?
Yeah, I like alligators and snakes.
So wait, another story.
I like what
that
Robert
white
was saying
cop
earlier.
Who got convicted of murder. She killed an unarmed black man in his apartment.
Yeah.
And she actually was convicted of murder.
Yeah. That's a big story.
And it has unrelated to Trump. See, listeners, we do talk about other things.
Obviously, Rosemary didn't read today's article.
No, she keeps,
because she's trying to
throw
everything
subject,
in the way.
Yeah. Kind of free-forming.
Come on, Rosemary. Free-forming.
Nonsense. I know all of it.
I think she actually is drunk.
I think... President Trump on Tuesday kept his focus on an anonymous whistleblower asking why he was not entitled to interview the person. A day after he said the White House was trying to find out the person's identity despite institutional directives and confidentiality protections. In addition to interviewing the so-called whistleblower, Mr. Trump wrote on Twitter on Tuesday he would also like to interview the person who gave all of the false information to him. On Sunday, Mr. Trump tweeted, "Like every American, I deserve to meet my accuser." Mr. Trump's focus on the whistleblower is one of several ways the White House has addressed the complaint, which alleged that Mr. Trump was using his office for personal gain in the phone call at the center of it between Mr. Trump and President Zelensky of Ukraine. Mr. Trump has repeatedly defended that conversation with Mr. Zelensky as
perfect.
That's correct. Mr. Trump.
Fill in the blank.
You get to move on. Mr. Trump is particularly focused on the source of the information the whistleblower disclosed and the facts that much of the whistleblower's most serious allegations were not witnessed firsthand. But witnessing actions is not a requirement for filing a complaint, according to the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community, which said on Monday in a release that a whistleblower need not possess firsthand information in order to file a complaint or information with respect to an urgent concern. But let's go to the first part of that New York Times article, which is this obsession of wanting to, quote, meet his accuser.
Absolutely. That's the big thing. He's scared to death of the accuser. Their polling is showing it. The person has credibility, and he has to do anything in his power to try to damage that person and their credibility.
It's also a situation where he's trying to send a note of warning to anybody else in the bureaucracy that would be thinking about
coming forward
and being a whistleblower. And if the thought is that, well, you know, I'm going to lose my job, I'm going to lose my pension, they're going to go after my family, I could end up dead, then people will, you know, it's a chilling effect on people's willingness to come forward.
What if today what the Inspector General has to meet with them about gives them information that almost makes what the whistleblower has to say almost insignificant because it's so much more powerful? I think what's going to start happening is that people are going to start coming forward. You can call them whistleblowers or not whistleblowers, but they're all going to start having pieces of information that are going to begin to take the focus off the whistleblower. And at some point, the president cannot reach out and point to every single person that's trying to accuse him and somehow develop a message that makes any sense. And I think he's starting to lose control of the narrative.
Well, he did that with the 20 women who accused him of groping. He pointed to all of them and said they're all liars, and it worked for him.
I don't
think he's up with your strategy yet.
And I think if you look at the history, the history is sue often, sue widely. Throw more money at the so you drain people's resources through court proceeds, I mean, this is
McCabe. Look what he's doing with the guy at the FBI.
Right,
perfect
which I thought
example.
Was really interesting because the judge just ordered that they either need to go or get off the pot, and that if not, they're going to release the documentation, which would be fascinating to watch. The other element that you can't lose sight of, though, Terry, is that throughout the bureaucracy now, there are Trumpites that are through there, and the concern isn't necessarily just the president doing this. It's the retribution from the political appointees, particularly political appointees who see this as a way of getting the Trump's attention, and you start to interview for jobs by being ridiculously overboard. So if you think of Whitaker and the mm-hmm. and what he pulled over yeah. justice, I mean that's the way a lot of the folks see the opportunity to rise.
Yeah, but there's another side to this, and the other side is that an awful lot of people who are in government now, who are political appointees, whether they're Volkers or not, who see the possibility of their entire lives being ruined because they are in compliance with this president, don't you think?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I worry so much about this whistleblower. I worry about their safety. I worry about their future. I worry about them just remaining safe between now and the time they actually get to testify. It's a horrible situation, and it seems like they must know who this person is, or at least have it narrowed down to two or three people.
It would. I mean, we know so much about the person that it's hard to imagine they don't have it narrowed down.
Yeah.
Let's go to, we have a few moments, let's go to a couple of other stories. The Harvard ruling, federal judge rules that Harvard does not discriminate against Asian Americans in admissions. A federal judge ruled Tuesday that Harvard University does not discriminate against Asian Americans in an undergraduate admissions, handing the school a victory in a lawsuit that marks one of the latest chapters in the affirmative action debate. The U.S. District Judge Allison Burroughs rejected a plaintiff's claim that Harvard violates the law as it considers race in selecting an incoming freshman class. While Harvard's admissions policies and process may be imperfect, Burroughs wrote that the judge concluded that statistical disparities among racial groups of applicants are not the result of any racial animus or conscious prejudice. The judge also found that Harvard narrowly tailored its use of race in admissions to achieve the benefits of a diverse class. I assume.
Let's see if this is the last stop in the judicial process.
Right.
No, I mean, that's one judge.
Yeah, I was about to say this is going to go all the way up. I would anticipate that the Supreme Court will take this up.
They have their sights on affirmative action. Yeah. So this is not something that is in accord with what they have ruled. So.
In the Students for Fair Admissions, if you look at their history, and if you look at Ed Bloom's history, I mean, he's tried to identify cases purposely that are going to undermine any of the tenets of affirmative action.
Harvard could improve its process through implicit bias training or other steps, the judge added. That being said, the court will not dismantle a very fine admissions program that passes constitutional muster solely because it could do better. The plaintiff, Students for Fair Admissions, a group that said it represents the interest of rejected Asian American applicants, vowed to an appeal of a case that could reach the Supreme Court, as was just mentioned. This also, of course, comes at the time of a national debate over race, class, and access to higher education as a scandal over a cheating and bribery scam to help the children of rich parents get into prominent universities has shaken public confidence in the admission systems. Around the world, Harvard is renowned for its exclusivity. Of 43,330 people who applied to enter as freshmen this fall, Harvard offered admission to 1,950, or 4.5%.
Wow.
That means roughly 19 of every 20 applicants were denied. The expected size of the class is about 1,660.
I thought it was cute that the judge actually was denied entrance to Harvard. And so she was actually talking about her own experiences.
It is interesting. You know, there was federal judge, now that you mention it, going off in a little bit of a direction. Federal Judge Neil McKern ran for Congress, lost, and then became federal judge, and then ruled that the kids had a right to vote from their dormitories, which would have had him winning. So every once in a while, there's a little get even here.
You know, it is an interesting case. You mentioned affirmative action, and obviously that's a big part of it. But it's a strange case in the sense that, you know, there are white kids who are getting advantaged under the way Harvard does it now, right? So, I mean, it's not purely about black and minority students. It's about, you know, white kids who are getting in who maybe didn't have the qualifications of some Asian students.
Which is, and, Chris, I think yeah. you're on to something that's yeah. going to be really interesting in the next 20 years as you look at the demographic shifts in this country. You know, the white demographic is not going to be the largest block in the country. So we're going to be seeing all sorts of changes, and there's going to be really interesting, I think, evolution of some of the principles that were put in place. It gets back, though, to, I think, one of the big things that I looked at with this case and was thinking about is the issue of social mobility becomes so important, and that can't get lost. And in a place like Harvard, it's not just an excellent education, it's the network that goes along with that. And you start to think about access to power and access to power players. You know, Harvard, for better or worse, is in a small group of universities that controls immense both formal and informal power because of their alumni base in university. So this really is an important case.
Well, these private universities like Harvard, they, you know, it's at the end of the day, they rely so heavily on a profit. They have to make sure that they're bringing people into their system that are connected to people that can generate donations to be put into the system. And they want people that are going to graduate and go on to be wealthy alumni that can give back to the system. And that factors into a lot of the decisions that they make. And it factors into also the income inequality that we have in this country right now, where still those who are coming from a, you know, European white background are often going to be in a position to be in a wealthier category than those who are people of color. And as the world becomes more diverse, that's going to become more problematic for these private universities because their pool of wealth is being condensed down into a place where it doesn't look like what they're used to, and they don't know what to do.
You know, it doesn't stop with Harvard. Mayor de Blasio was concerned that so many Asian students, for example, let's face it, were the majority in getting into the specialized schools in New York, in New York City, and he lost on that.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah. We have just about 3 minutes. I wanted to – we're starting to get the tax filings or the third quarter fundraising for the presidential candidates is coming out. Andrew Yang raised $10 million in 3 months.
Is Biden – do we know Biden's yet?
Biden –
we don't know Biden.
Biden and Warren have not released theirs as of yet.
But Bernie did very well.
Bernie did $25.3 million. Mayor Pete had $19.1 million. Senator Kamala Harris, $11.6 million. And Senator Cory Booker, $6 million.
The Sanders thing is really interesting because he's not doing all that well in the polls, but he's going to have enough money to really stick around to the very end if he wants to.
And will.
But Donald Trump, the person who is facing an impeachment, raised $125 million, which
sure, you know why. You want something, you want something, you give something to somebody who's in office who can help you. It's that simple.
All right, on that very sobering note.
It's terrifying.
All right. Well, we'll call it there. Thank you very much for being with us. A reminder, help that lockbox, right, Alan?
Boy, I'll tell you, it's where we live. It's why if anybody loves this radio station, they should do something right now. Just go to WAMC.org and put a little something in.
WAMC.org. Don't forget a pair of tickets to Capitol Steps of the Egg. $150. Right. Friday, November 1st, 7:30, and you can do that as well. WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262. Alan, Terry, Chris, Bob, and Rosemary, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.